Chapter 11. Absolute protests en masse against the monarchical principle. They were the uprising of the people against the oppressive degeneration of legality. But there never has been any legality in Russia. She is a negation of that, as of everything else, that has its root in reason or conscience. The ground of every revolution had to be intellectually prepared. A revolution is a shortcut in the rational development of national needs in response to the growth of worldwide ideals. It is conceivably possible for a monarch of genius to put himself at the head of a revolution without ceasing to be the king of his people. For the autocracy of Holy Russia, the only conceivable self-reform is suicide. The same relentless fate holds in its grip the all-powerful ruler and his helpless people. Wielders of a power purchased by an unspeakable baseness of subjection to the Khans of the Tartar horde, the princes of Russia who, in their heart of hearts, had come in time to regard themselves as superior to every monarch of Europe, have never risen to be the chiefs of a nation. Their authority has never been sanctioned by popular tradition, by ideas of intelligent loyalty, of devotion, of political necessity, of simple expediency, or even by the power of the sword. In whatever form of upheaval autocratic Russia is to find her end, it can never be a revolution fruitful of moral consequences to mankind. It cannot be anything else but a rising of slaves. It is a tragic circumstance that the only thing one can wish to that people who had never seen face to face either law, order, justice, right, truth about itself or the rest of the world, who had known nothing outside the capricious will of its irresponsible masters, is that it should find in the approaching hour of need, not an organizer or a lawgiver, with the wisdom of a Lycurgus, or a Solon for their service, but at least the force of energy and desperation in some as yet unknown Spartacus. A brand of hopeless mental and moral inferiority is set upon Russian achievements, and the coming events of her internal changes, however appalling they may be in their magnitude, will be nothing more impressive than the convulsions of a colossal body. As her boasted military force that, corrupt in its origin, has ever struck no other but faltering blows, so her soul, kept benumbed by her temporal and spiritual master with the poison of tyranny and superstition, will find itself on awakening possessed of no language, a monstrous full-grown child having first to learn the ways of living thought and articulate speech. It is safe to say tyranny, assuming a thousand protean shapes, will remain clinging to her struggles for a long time before her blind multitudes succeed at last in trampling her out of existence under their millions of bare feet. That would be the beginning. What is to come after? The conquest of freedom, to call your soul your own, is only the first step on the road to excellence. We, in Europe, have gone a step or two further, have had the time to forget how little that freedom means. To Russia it must seem everything. A prisoner shut up in a noisome dungeon concentrates all his hope and desire on the moment of stepping out beyond the gates. It appears to him pregnant with an immense and final importance, whereas what is important is the spirit in which he will draw the first breath of freedom, the counsels he will hear, the hands he may find extended, the endless days of toil that must follow, wherein he will have to build his future with no other material but what he can find within himself. It would be vain for Russia to hope for the support and counsel of collective wisdom. Since 1870, as a distinguished statesman of the old tradition disconsolately exclaimed, El Nye plus Europe. There is, indeed, no Europe. The idea of a Europe united in the solidarity of her dynasties, which for a moment seemed to dawn on the horizon of the Vienna Congress through the subsiding dust of Napoleonic alarums and excursions, has been extinguished by the larger glamour of less restraining ideals. Instead of the doctrines of solidarity, it was the doctrine of nationalities much more favorable to spoliations that came to the front, and since its greatest triumphs at Sadowa and Sedan there is no Europe. Meanwhile, till the time comes when there will be no frontiers, there are alliances so shamelessly based upon the exigencies of suspicion and mistrust that their cohesive force waxes and wanes with every year, almost with the event of every passing month. This is the atmosphere Russia will find when the last rampart of tyranny has been beaten down. But what hands, what voices will she find on coming out into the light of day? An ally as he has, yet who more than any other of Russia's allies has found that it had parted with lots of solid substance in exchange for a shadow. It is true that the shadow was indeed the mightiest, the darkest that the modern world had ever known and the most overbearing. But it is fading now, and the tone of truest anxiety as to what is to take its place will come, no doubt, from that and no other direction, and no doubt, also, it will have that note of generosity which even in the moments of greatest aberration is seldom wanting in the voice of the French people. Two neighbors Russia will find at her door. Austria, traditionally unaggressive whenever her hand is not forced, ruled by a dynasty of uncertain future, weakened by her duality, can only speak to her in an uncertain, bilingual phrase. Prussia, grown in something like 40 years from an almost pitiful dependent into a bullying friend, and evil counselor of Russia's masters, may, indeed, hasten to extend a strong hand to the weakness of her exhausted body, but if so it will be only with the intention of tearing away the long-coveted part of her substance. Pan-Germanism is by no means a shape of mists, and Germany is anything but a need, where thought and effort are likely to lose themselves without sound or trace. It is a powerful and voracious organization, full of unscrupulous self-confidence, whose appetite for aggrandizement will only be limited by the power of helping itself to the severed members of its friends and neighbors. The era of war so eloquently denounced by the old Republicans as the peculiar blood guilt of dynastic ambitions is by no means over yet. They will be fought out differently, with lesser frequency, with an increased bitterness and the savage tooth and claw obstinacy of a struggle for existence. They will make us regret the time of dynastic ambitions, with their human absurdity moderated by prudence, and even by shame, by the fear of personal responsibility, and the regard paid to certain forms of conventional decency. For, if the monarchs of Europe have been derided for addressing each other as brother in autograph communications, that relationship was at least as effective as any form of brotherhood likely to be established between the rival nations of this continent, which, we are assured on all hands, is the heritage of democracy. In the ceremonial brotherhood of monarchs, the reality of blood ties, for what little it is worth, acted often as a drag on unscrupulous desires of glory or greed. Besides, there was always the common danger of exasperated peoples, and some respect for each other's divine right. No leader of a democracy, without other ancestry, but the sudden shout of a multitude, and debarred by the very condition of his power from even thinking of a direct heir, will have any interest in calling brother the leader of another democracy a chief as fatherless and heirless as himself. The War of 1870, brought about by the Third Napoleon's half-generous, half-selfish adoption of the principle of nationalities, was the first war characterized by a special intensity of hate, by a new note in the tune of an old song for which we may thank the Teutonic thoroughness. Was it not that excellent Burgius, Princess Bismarck, to keep only two great examples, who was so righteously anxious to see men, women, and children, emphatically the children, two of the abominable French nation massacred off the face of the earth? This illustration of the new war temper is artlessly revealed in the prattle of the amiable Bush, the Chancellor's pet epistle of the press. And this was supposed to be a war for an idea. Too much, however, should not be made of that good wife's and mother's sentiments any more than of the good first Emperor William's tears, shed so abundantly after every battle, by letter, telegram, and otherwise, during the course of the same war, before a dumb and shamefaced continent. These were merely the expressions of the simplicity of a nation which more than any other has a tendency to run into the grotesque. There is worse to come. Today, in the fierce grapple of two nations of different race, the short era of national wars seems about to close. No war will be waged for an idea. The oxycidal aristocracies of yesterday fought without malice for an occupation, for the honor, for the fun of the thing. The virtuous, industrious democratic states of tomorrow may yet be reduced to fighting for a crust of dry bread, with all the hate, ferocity, and fury that must attach to the vital importance of such an issue. The dreams sanguine humanitarians raised, almost to ecstasy about the year 50 of the last century by the moving sight of the Crystal Palace crammed full with that variegated rubbish which it seems to be the bizarre fate of humanity, to produce for the benefit of a few employers of labor have vanished as quickly as they had arisen. The golden hopes of peace have in a single night turned to dead leaves in every drawer of every benevolent theorist's writing table. A swift disenchantment overtook the incredible infatuation which could put its trust in the peaceful nature of industrial and commercial competition. Industrialism and commercialism, wearing high-sounding names in many languages, welt politik may serve for one instance, picking up coins behind the severe and disdainful figure of science whose giant strides have widened for us the horizon of the universe by some few inches, stand ready, almost eager, to appeal to the sword, as soon as the globe of the earth has shrunk beneath our growing numbers by another ell or so. And democracy, which has elected to pin its faith to the supremacy of material interests, will have to fight their battles to the bitter end, on a mere pittance unless, indeed, some statesman of exceptional ability and overwhelming prestige succeeds in carrying through an international understanding for the delimitation of spheres of trade all over the earth, on the model of the territorial spheres of influence marked in Africa, to keep the competitors for the privilege of improving the nigger as a buying machine from flying prematurely at each other's throats. This seems the only expedient at hand for the temporary maintenance of European peace, with its alliances based on mutual distrust, preparedness for war as its ideal, and the fear of wounds, luckily stronger, so far, than the pinch of hunger, its only guarantee. The true peace of the world will be a place of refuge much less like a beleaguered fortress and more, let us hope, in the nature of an inviolable temple. It will be built on less perishable foundations than those of material interests. But it must be confessed that the architectural aspect of the universal city remains as yet inconceivable, that the very ground for its erection has not been cleared of the jungle. Never before in history has the right of war been more fully admitted in the rounded periods of public speeches, in books, in public prints, in all the public works of peace, culminating in the establishment of the Hague Tribunal, that solemnly official recognition of the earth as a house of strife. To him whose indignation is qualified by a measure of hope and affection, the efforts of mankind to work its own salvation present a sight of alarming comicality. After clinging for ages to the steps of the heavenly throne, they are now, without much modifying their attitude, trying with touching ingenuity to steal one by one the thunderbolts of their Jupiter. They have removed war from the list of heaven-sent visitations that could only be prayed against. They have erased its name from the supplication against the wrath of war, pestilence, and famine, as it is found in the litanies of the Roman Catholic Church. They have dragged the scourge down from the skies, and have made it into a calm and regulated institution. At first sight the change does not seem for the better. Jove's thunderbolt looks a most dangerous plaything in the hands of the people. But a solemnly established institution begins to grow old at once in the discussion, abuse, worship, and execration of men. It grows obsolete, odious, and intolerable. It stands fatally condemned to an unhonored old age. Therein lies the best hope of advanced thought, and the best way to help its prospects is to provide in the fullest, frankest way for the conditions of the present day. War is one of its conditions. It is its principal condition. It lies at the heart of every question agitating the fears and hopes of a humanity divided against itself. The succeeding ages have changed nothing except the watchwords of the armies. The intellectual stage of mankind being as yet in its infancy, and states, like most individuals, having but a feeble and imperfect consciousness of the worth and force of the inner life, the need of making their existence manifest to themselves is determined in the direction of physical activity. The idea of ceasing to grow in territory, in strength, in wealth, in influence, in anything but wisdom and self-knowledge is odious to them as the omen of the end. Action, in which is to be found the illusion of a master destiny, can alone satisfy our uneasy vanity, and lay to rest the haunting fear of the future, a sentiment concealed, indeed, but proving its existence by the force it has, when invoked, to stir the passions of a nation. It will be long before we have learned that in the great darkness before us there is nothing that we need fear. Let us act lest we perish is the cry. And the only form of action open to a state can be of no other than aggressive nature. There are many kinds of aggressions, though the sanction of them is one and the same the magazine rifle of the latest pattern. In preparation for, or against that form of action, the states of Europe are spending now such moments of uneasy leisure as they can snatch from the labors of factory and counting house. Never before has war received so much homage at the lips of men, and reigned with less disputed sway in their minds. It has harnessed science to its gun carriages, it has enriched a few respectable manufacturers, scattered doles of food and raiment amongst a few thousand skilled workmen, devoured the first youth of whole generations, and reaped its harvest of countless corpses. It has perverted the intelligence of men, women, and children, and has made the speeches of emperors, kings, presidents, and ministers monotonous with ardent protestations of fidelity to peace. Indeed, war has made peace altogether its own, it has modeled it on its own image. A martial, overbearing, warlord sort of peace, with a mailed fist, and turned-up mustaches, ringing with the din of grand maneuvers, eloquent with allusions to glorious feats of arms. It has made peace so magnificent as to be almost as expensive to keep up as itself. It has sent out apostles of its own, who at one time went about mostly in newspapers, preaching the gospel of the mystic sanctity of its sacrifices and the regenerating power of spilt blood, to the poor in mind whose name is Legion. It has been observed that in the course of earthly greatness a day of culminating triumph is often paid for by a morrow of sudden extinction. Let us hope it is so. Yet the dawn of that day of retribution may be a long time breaking above a dark horizon. War is with us now, and, whether this one ends soon or late, war will be with us again. And it is the way of true wisdom for men and states to take account of things as they are. Civilization has done its little best by our sensibilities for whose growth it is responsible. It has managed to remove the sights and sounds of battlefields away from our doorsteps. But it cannot be expected to achieve the feat always and under every variety of circumstance. Someday it must fail, and we shall have then a wealth of appallingly unpleasant sensations brought home to us with painful intimacy. It is not absurd to suppose that, whatever war comes to us next, it will not be a distant war waged by Russia either beyond the Amur or beyond the Oxus. The Japanese armies have laid that ghost forever, because the Russia of the future will not, for the reasons explained above, be the Russia of today. It will not have the same thoughts, resentments, and aims. It is even a question whether it will preserve its gigantic frame unaltered and unbroken. All speculation loses itself in the magnitude of the events made possible by the defeat of an autocracy whose only shadow of a title to existence was the invincible power of military conquest. That autocratic Russia will have a miserable end in harmony with its base origin and inglorious life does not seem open to doubt. The problem of the immediate future is posed not by the eventual manner, but by the approaching fact of its disappearance. The Japanese armies, in laying the oppressive ghost, have not only accomplished what will be recognized historically as an important mission in the world's struggle against all forms of evil, but have. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.